I'm going to talk about a machine which has fascinated me for a while. I had absolutely nothing to do with building it. I never used it. But I did know several of the people who were key to building it. And I had the opportunity to discuss it with them, and I became kind of interested in it. Part of the reason I think it's interesting is because what was accomplished, admittedly with a lot of money, but with a lot of very clever engineering, at a time when the industry was really, pre-PC. I'll say a little bit more about that, but I think this computer is a quite amazing piece of engineering in any case, but especially given how early it was built, and I'll say more about that. It had rather aggressive goals, and I think it's probably a good indication of what you can do when you try and meet that. So the context for this is that in the late 1950s, IBM built a computer called Stretch. It was pretty well known at the time. It was the fastest machine in the world for several years in a row. It was eventually displaced by the CDC 6600. It was built with very, very aggressive performance goals. It didn't meet them, and I'll say more about that in a moment. But basically, its performance goal was to compute 100 times faster than the 704. The 704 was a quite successful machine. I'm sorry. The 704 was a machine which was shipped in 1955, 1956, was quite successful. For its time, it was pretty good. But Stretch never really met the goal of 100 times the performance. It maybe reached half of that. It was a very limited project. This is a machine which would have filled at least half of this room. And it was sold basically to national laboratories, the Weather Bureau, people like that who have a lot of money and really need to compute a lot. When it was clear that it didn't meet its goal, the president of IBM, Thomas Watson Jr., got up at the 1961 Full Joint Computer Conference and basically apologized, lowered the price roughly in half, and stopped taking orders, and sent the engineering manager to the doghouse for failure to meet his commitments. He later was vindicated, but it did take a few years. Even having not met its goals, it was the fastest machine in the world, as I said, from about 1961 to 1964, roughly. Stretch is not a machine I want to talk about a lot, other than just to give you a little bit of context for the one I do want to talk about. Stretch was a memory at a 2 to the 18th words of memory, 64-bit words. It had single error correction and double error detection on the memory. It was all core memory, for those of you who remember what that is. 16 index registers, accumulator, and MQ, sort of a traditional architecture for that era. It was all built out of discrete transistors. At the time, pretty much everything was built out of discrete transistors. It was IBM's first transistorized machine. Up until that time, everything had been built with vacuum tubes, except for the stuff that was built with relays. The memory design that was done for Stretch was later used very successfully for the IBM 7090, 7094, and a couple of other machines, although not with error correcting, with the error correcting bits used for data storage, because the memories were that reliable, it was felt to be necessary. But Stretch had quite a few firsts. It was the first machine that really had 8-bit bytes. In fact, the word byte was invented for Stretch by one of the engineers. So it supported upper and lowercase alphabetics in a serious way. It had very aggressive look ahead. That was related to the performance, of course. Could have pieces of up to 11 instructions in flight at once. They called that mechanism look ahead, or also virtual memory, sort of a misnomer for the way we use the term today. But but that was very aggressive and very complicated, and they were able to build a performance model of that, which was quite accurate, which allowed them to change several aspects of the design before the machine hardware was built. John Cock, who later won a Turing Award for his work in high-performance computing, was one of the authors of that, and Stretch was the first machine that he had really had a serious role in. It had a very novel and rather strong interrupt system that was designed by Fred Brooks, also a Turing Award winner. And it was the first machine, I believe, certainly the first IBM machine, that had standardized I/O interfaces so that all I/O devices connected essentially to the same kind of interface on channels. It is the subject of a book. If you're interested in this kind of thing about how machines get built and the architecture, I recommend it very highly. You can find a copy online. It's been scanned. I think there's a copy in BitSavers. It's well worth reading if you have an interest in this. So roughly what the machine looked like is this. I say memory bus here, but it's really a little more complicated than just a bus. It's more of an exchange, interfacing between CPU and multiple banks of memory, up to 8 of them. The exchange is where all of the I/O and I/O channels are, and the dots on the left indicate the standard interfaces to tapes, printer, card units. This is an era, needless to say, when people were still programming with cards. There was no interactive systems, and it's quite a different environment from what we have today. So, moving now a little bit more to Harvest, it was motivated by the problems of cryptanalysis. I'm not going to talk about what NSA does. I think we probably all know in this crowd. But in that era, this was before public key cryptography. Everything was, or most cryptography was done by machines like Enigma from World War II, and derivatives of that, and the energy, the cryptanalytic energy of NSA went into building that. They had a history of custom building their own machines. This was not the first one by any means. Probably, I know 6 or 7 before this, and I'm sure there were more than that. But the era here, the context here is that disks were announced in 1956, delivered in 1957, and in this time frame were still pretty unreliable. Very, very small capacity compared to what we have today. Computing, as I mentioned, was universally batch, and data storage was basically on tape. So this precedes CTSS. For those of you who don't know, that's the compatible time sharing system, Project Mac at MIT. That work was done around 1963, before COBOL, certainly before integrated circuits. And as I mentioned, it was the first transistorized system. So just to, again, for this audience, this may not be necessary, but to motivate the discussion a little bit, this is the kind of cryptographic machine we're talking about trying to break. This was used by the Germans during World War II. This is one version of it. The way this worked is the operator typed on the keyboard, and one of these letters lit up, corresponding to it. And in addition to that, the cryptographic state of the machine, which is encapsulated in the state of these three rotors here, advanced and changed it. And for the next letter, a different setting would be used. So if you type the same letter twice in a row, of course, it would not be encrypted the same way. There were multiple versions of the machine. The picture shows three rotors. Some machines had 5. The specific rotors that were used on any particular day were chosen from a larger set, usually of 7 or 9, and used in different orders. So it was quite a difficult machine to understand in terms of it's constantly changing state. There's a lot of work done at Bletchley Park in the United Kingdom. Alan Turing contributed a lot to breaking this. And if you've seen the Imitation Game, you've seen some efforts of that, although the movie is not really very accurate in terms of the cryptographic aspects of it. But if you don't know about it, I do recommend learning about it. It's quite fascinating and I think quite important. So this is what one of those wheels looks like, and it's sort of exploded view. You can see the wires. The wires on different of those rotors are different, of course, and that's part of the encryption, of course, and the key, the secret, so to speak. And just to give a very oversimplified view of what's going on here, you can see the path that starts with the letter A in the top there, goes through an arbitrary path depending on the current state of the rotors, comes out and lights, in this example, the B, and that's basically the encrypted data. Doing it a second time, typing a B with the machine in the same state yields the unencrypted data, the A, and that's what's done on the receiving end. So there was an earlier project called NOMAD, which was being built by Raytheon, which failed to produce anything, and NSA was rather frustrated in talking to IBM. And IBM said, let us try it, and started discussions on the details. And in fact, at first, they were contemplating a machine with a 60-bit word length, which I find kind of ironic. But interestingly, the reason for considering 60 bits, because 60 is a multiple of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And the machine that I mentioned before, the 6600, is also a 60-bit machine, or is actually a 60-bit machine, I should say. And the reason for it being 60 is that 60 is a multiple of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 12, and 15, all of which numbers have a role either in the physical packaging of the machine or the architecture. But that's a little bit off the track here. So I don't know whether the transition of the names here from nomad to farmer, from somebody who stays in one place, or somebody who moves around to somebody who stays in one place, and farms was a conscious decision. I can only assume it was, but it led to Project Farmer, which was the name of the project under which this work was done, and specific components of it. Harvest, that we're talking about, of course. Tractor is the tape system. Silo, I don't remember what silo is, but it's another piece of it. More or less at the same time, IBM was starting to negotiate, mostly with Los Alamos, to build Stretch and some other customers. And it turned out that Stretch was a good fit because it was sort of also a rather massive machine, had a long word length, high performance, and Stretch, in effect, formed the nest into which, if you will, Harvest was built. So IBM delivered 8 or 9 of the Stretch machines, and Harvest was the last one delivered with the adjunct for Stretch. In other words, it operates on the same memory or out of the same memory, but it is roughly twice the size and circuit count of the Stretch itself. So it's quite a massive machine. I'll show you a picture in a moment. In addition to the processor, there was a rather massive tape system, which I'll also talk about. As I said, this was an era in which there was no online storage, really. And NSA needed that, and that was part of this project. Just to set the context for NSA, there's this sort of amusing story that's told about what happened when Harvest was delivered. I assume you all know what a chain printer is, or a train printer. If you don't, it's a printer which has images of letters on a metal chain, which spins which moves horizontally in front of the paper. And when the right letter flies by, a hammer behind the paper hits the paper against against this moving chain. The chain is moving quite fast. When the machine was delivered to NSA in 1962, February of 1962, IBM had provided some simulation software so that NSA could start to develop application programs and get used to programming the machine. They had an application that worked on the simulator. They were very anxious to try it on the real machine. Nobody really expected it to work, from what I understand. But there's always the faint hope that maybe it will. And a bunch of the people who had written it were gathered around the printer, again, one of these chain printers, 1403, for those of you who know what that is. And after the machine computed for a while, it started printing. And the results came. They were not correct answers. They were not wrong answers. Everything was sheer gibberish, complete gibberish. And everybody was sort of disappointed, except for one fellow who was standing in the front and looking at it with getting bigger and bigger eyes, saying, "It's working, it's working, it's working perfectly." And ultimately, although it took a while to discover it, he was right. But what had happened was that when the engineers had been testing the machine and finishing the installation, they had inserted the chain into this printer incorrectly. So it was effectively doing, at 600 lines a minute, mechanically, a substitution cipher, if you will. And this guy had apparently figured that out, solved it, and was applying it at 600 lines a minute and correctly had realized that everything was going. So you can take what you want from that story. I find it very amusing. But it's sort of an indication, maybe, of the skill and the minds that they've hired there, some of which is necessary to program the machine, as you'll see. So, a little bit general about what Harvest is. It basically treats the stretch memory as a long string of bits. It completely ignores word boundaries. There's 64-bit words physically, but it hides that. Addresses the memory with a suitably long address. And basically, what the structure of the machine is a pair of essentially identical streaming units, which address memory and fetch bytes. 8-bit bytes, 7-bit bytes, 6-bit bytes, whatever you want, up to 8, and provide a stream of those bytes, two of them. They are delivered to a processing unit, in fact, a pair of processing units. The processing unit creates bytes as a result of that input and stores a third stream of bytes. So I'll show you a picture in a moment. So the memory is used as two sources of data, one sink of data, and also used to store some results, table lookup, and use individual bits for recording the presence of various things that have been observed in the data. Okay, these instructions were designed to run for many hundreds and thousands of bytes. They're rather complicated to set up. They're typically 200 to 300 bits necessary to set up to configure the machine to execute one of these instructions. The instructions are interruptible and can be restarted, and they can be interrupted for the purpose of allowing software to intervene. Software to intervene in the process when some particular condition has been observed, take some action, possibly modifying some of the data, and then resume. So this is a summary. I'm not going to explain all of this, but this is basically the tables or the inputs which are stored in memory by the application program that is using the streaming unit, and then fetched by the streaming unit to configure itself for this streaming. So basically, the stretch processor and harvest don't operate at the same time. I think that's partly because the memory bus can't really deal with that kind of load. It probably would be kind of productive, but it also would introduce some synchronization problems. So basically, stretch executes a branch to harvest. Harvest computes, eventually stops, and the arithmetic processor, as they refer to it, continues. So the main instruction basically that's been added is streaming byte by byte. That's what I was describing. There are a few variants of that, which I'm not going to talk about, which are basically special configurations of that instruction. So what harvest adds to the basic stretch thing is the stuff on the right, the harvest processor, of course, a high speed exchange to deal with Tractor. Tractor was quite a bit higher data rate than the tape drives at the time, and then also a couple or up to four, although only two were configured ultimately, high-speed memories. These are also core memory, but 7/10 of a microsecond full cycle time, which is actually quite fast for core in that era. So here's a sort of simplified picture of it. Starting in memory, this is the memory which is also shared with stretch. We have these two source units, they're called P and Q, which each of which is configured with addressing information. And each of these can have several levels of addressing, so that it doesn't just fetch sequential bits. It can fetch three bytes in a row, skip some number of bits, start, go backwards, and that behavior is programmed by setup in memory that configures each of the units. There's a mask unit, which essentially ands a constant. If you want to use fewer than 8-bit bytes, you can, in effect, mask out additional ones to get narrower ones. I'll skip the match units for a moment. And then there are basically two units that do the guts of the data processing. One is called the table lookup facility, where basically the two input bytes are taken, assembled into an address. That address can be used to set a bit in the high-speed memory that says that particular combination of two bytes has occurred, to increment a counter of variable length in memory, and that addition happens within the memory because for performance reasons it couldn't be done with a fetch and restore. Or to look something up in a table, again, in the high-speed memory, and based on bits that come out in that table, to take further actions. There's a statistical accumulator that allows counting how many events of a specific kind have happened. And also, they can form a third byte stream from the table lookup that, again, goes back to memory through the third of these, in this case, a sync unit, the one that stores data. It's essentially the same as the other in terms of its addressing ability. The other, this is the same picture except now with the logic unit instead of the table lookup, basically. Similar, taking two bytes of data from the two sources, doing arithmetic on them, doing any of 16 logical connectives on them on the corresponding bits bit by bit, producing another byte stream which goes back to memory. Now I just want to go back and talk about these match units. They're actually there are about 30 places in the machine where the match units can sample the data as it goes by, compare it with a constant that's loaded into the match register, and if some condition is met, equality, not equal, greater than, less than, certain bits being one, so it's quite flexible. Then a stimulus arises, a signal arises, and that signal can be used to cause an action in any of about 30 places within the machine in different match. Okay, so I'm sorry, this is the stimulus this response. So monitor the data as it goes by. Replace the data, stop the machine, allow the arithmetic processor to take over, hold the state of the computation in stretch, in harvest, and then resume it. That's all sort of normal operation. Yeah, I think it's said all this. They went to quite a bit of engineering effort to design it so that it really behaves logically the way the streaming units would like it to, so that partial word fetches and things like that, or modifying parts of a word are handled correctly. And so this is what it looks like. I don't know. I don't know if you can get a sense of the scale. These cabinets are about as tall as I am, a little more, actually. This does not include stretch. Stretch is another, basically, half of this. It came with you can't really tell in these photographs, but both of these consoles are full of lights. Describing the state of the machine, and there's a third console that's used more for operations as well. So now let me talk about this tape system called Tractor. Again, here the goal was 100 times the performance of the 704 tape system. This goal was met, although there were some rocky stretches along the way getting there. I say tapes, but in fact they're what you might think of as cassettes, although not on a scale like the old audio cassettes that we remember. The tapes, 1,800 feet, 1 3/4 inches wide, and with 23 tracks on them, 16 data tracks, 6 tracks for single error correction, double error detection, and a 23rd track to basically mark tape errors. So that when a write error has been found, it won't try and write over it. It'll skip it. I don't know of any other machine that has that. In addition, every fifth data byte was a non-data byte used for synchronization and clocking. And the result was that the transfer rate of 1.1 megabytes a second, a little bit faster than the streaming units, which were 1 megabyte a second. So one of the things that Jim Pomeroy, who was the engineer in charge of this, was most proud of, he told me about it several times, was basically that you could run the streaming unit and feed it with data from two tapes into memory, write data on a third tape, and the system was balanced in such a way that the tapes could keep up with the processor, the processor could run effectively continuously for hours, literally. Tapes move quite fast, 235 inches a second. I think that's about 19 miles an hour, if I did the arithmetic correctly. Again, with a transfer rate of a little over a megabyte. These tapes, I'll show you a picture in a moment, were stored in libraries. They were too heavy and a little too big to be easily handled by people on a regular basis. So they were stored in libraries that had 80 cassettes. Those were paired with a unit which could retrieve them and mount them on the physical tape drives. There were three of those units, so the total in the system was about 44 gigabytes of storage, which again you can buy that, you know, for a pittance nowadays, but in 1960 or 1962 you couldn't. And it's quite amazing to me what they were able to accomplish. Each cassette was about 90 megabytes. There was also a rudimentary file system on these tapes. I haven't been able to find much documentation on it, but they did have named files. There was a directory, or catalog, as IBM liked to call it at the time, and I don't think there was any ability to replace a file on tape, but there was at least readability for stored files. Okay. This is what one of those cassettes looks like. That's a 1 liter water bottle on the left. Okay. You can see the four wheels on the top. So these are basically stored hanging. In the library, I'll say more about this later. But IBM got Harvest back from NSA after it was no longer used, and that's how I was able to take this picture. And this is a picture of that tape library. So looking at the photograph on the right here. In fact, let me go to this. This is a logical picture of it. There's a tape drive here on the right and a tape drive here on the left. The library that stores the cassettes is here. And a second one here, 80 on each side. And in between them is an XY mechanism that can fetch a tape, bring it to the front to a tape handling unit here on the left or on the right, and receive a tape that's going back to the library from that and return it. So going back now to this, you can see this tape handler in the middle. On the right-hand side here, this is a tape drive that has no tape mounted in it at the moment. These tapes, by the way, had vacuum columns, for those of you who remember what vacuum columns are. And here's a tape waiting to go, either to be mounted or to go back to the library. I can't really tell. So this is one of three libraries. There were three essentially identical ones like that. Okay. I'm just going to say a few words about programming. There was a programming language developed for this called Alpha. I say language in quotes because it is not, to my thinking, a language. It is certainly not a language that's anything like any modern language that we know. It's one step above assembler, in my opinion. And its capabilities are very much what the capabilities of Harvest are. not exact direct mapping, but very, very close to that. It's also very specialized toward the cryptanalysis process, at least as I understand it. It's very flexible about design of character sets or definition of character sets. You can have a character set that has up to 256 characters, including a scab, which, as a friend of mine said this morning, is sort of like the character equivalent of a NaN, of a floating point, not a number outside the space. I think that's a good analogy. It allows definition of strings of data, of course, groups of strings they called chords, groups of chords they call ropes. Those are all primitives in the language. There's elaborate subscripting on these strings, elaborate operations similar to the ones that I mentioned earlier. They allow you to take an object and redefine it, in effect create a different name for it, which treats it with different geometry. In effect, a little bit like what Fortran does with an equivalence statement, where you can, in effect, have two arrays with different dimensions occupying the same storage. In Fortran, to my knowledge, it's really only ever done to save storage for arrays that are not needed at the same time. In Alpha, it seems to be done as an aspect of solving the problem or trying to solve the problem. So this is a sample of what Alpha looks like. This is just taken directly from the manual. I do not understand this. I'm not going to attempt to explain it. But you can see basically each of these operations corresponds to either just something that's being done at runtime or to an operation that's being done on harvest. So the machine ran in production from 1962 to 1976. The rumors, and I've heard this from two different paths, say that at the time it was retired, at which time, by the way, the Cray 1 had been delivered, that it was still NSA's most productive machine by a lot. I can't say anything more than that. I don't know anything more than that. But I think that's a very telling statement. A lot of that is, of course, due to the fact that the machine was very specifically designed with their needs in mind. It was retired mostly because the tractor tape drive system basically wore out. The leads, mechanical lead screws, I think for the for that unit in the center, wore, and the company that had made them originally was no longer a business. So it's another lost technology, unfortunately, but it couldn't be replaced, couldn't be repaired. NSA did apparently ask IBM to rebuild the machine in newer technology, but IBM declined. There's another sort of amusing story is that when the machine was decommissioned, they called up to the guy who deals with historical machines in IBM and offered it to him. And he said, sure, I'd love to have it. And they were all ready to hacksaw the cables, unfortunately. But a congressman of the time, Bill Abzug, got word of this, the fact that NSA had basically given the machine to IBM and said, nothing doing. You have to send it out for bids. Let somebody who wants it should have it. Fair chance to get it, and they did do that, but fortunately, the IBM department, even though it was towards the end of the year, basically bid all of their remaining cash on the machine and got it for, I think, $20,500. So IBM did recover the machine and had it from about 76 or 77 until the early 90s when it was just too expensive to pay the storage for it. So I have seen it. It was quite impressive. And I was given a cassette, one that shows in that photograph, which I've since given to the Computer History Museum. So it's in Mountain View. Why is it interesting? Well, obviously, it's a very unusual architecture. It's very powerful. It's very difficult to program. But it shows what you can do if you, again, have a lot of money. I think the cost of the machine was about $15 million, above the cost of the Stretch. It's another example of defense needs and military needs pushing technology. There's a lot of that. I don't think the story is as well known as it deserves to be. As I've said, it was extremely capable for its time, and the storage system took disks quite a while to catch up with that kind of capacity. It also, some of this is really Stretch more than Harvest, but it really set the direction for a lot of future architecture, sort of established the 8-bit byte standard, which was not a thing prior to that time. A lot of innovations from Stretch in particular went into the IBM System 360. Interruptible instructions, another thing which showed up not in 360 but in 370. And I mentioned standard IO interfaces. So I'm going to stop there. Thank you. And I will try and answer any questions if I can stay near the mic. Please. The question is, how often did IBM build custom machines like this? The answer, to my knowledge, is not very many. There are some recent examples in the supercomputer era, sort of from the late 80s, when IBM built BlueJean, and that's all very public. There were a couple of other IBM of those machines that I mentioned that NSA had custom built. A couple of them were built by IBM, but also Remington Rand also built at least one of them. There were certainly audio. The question is about the cassettes, the tape cassette, and whether there were other examples of the use of that. In the PC era, there were certainly audio cassettes that were used for data storage. That was pretty common. That's right. I know of no other use of and this stuff which I described for Stretch, it did lead to something called hypertape, which is similar but certainly not the same. The tape is narrower. I don't remember how wide it is. I think it's 1 inch. And the cassettes are a little bit smaller and a little more manageable. And it was not a very successful product that was sold, I think, to the Social Security Administration, but not anybody else. I think there was like a real. Yeah, and the picture I showed couldn't see it, but I'm sorry. The questions are about the configuration of the tape and whether there were any other cassette things. And one of the people in the audience says there were some broadcast tapes that were similar to that. Like there was U-matic, that was much later, I think. I'm sorry, Ampex would have been. Okay, but that was reels too, wasn't it?
Single reel, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Thank you. The question is about what was the rate of it? As I said, the rate through the unit was a megabyte. There was no flops because none of what I described was floating point. Stretch did floating point, I think it was roughly one megaflop, but I'm not certain of that. Yes. I know of none. The question was about contemporary accounts of what it was like to operate it. There may be things inside NSA. I filed one Freedom of Information Act request, and they responded to it, and they said, we've sent it to the National Archives. The National Archives couldn't find it. Yeah, the question is basically, how did the machine keep going? Is that what you're... There were 30 some odd conditions which could potentially stop the machine, or cause some action to happen. Question was, why put so much effort into byte sizes less than 8? I can only speculate. I think part of it is because it was still in an era when storage was expensive, and you know, Cyrillic has, I think, a 26 or 27 character alphabet also. And if you can get away with storing it in 5 bits, why use 8? Let me try and repeat the question. The question is an observation, really, that there was a lot of clever mechanical engineering, maybe even more than electrical engineering. I think there was a lot of both. But I myself agree with you. And I have said that certainly in the 50s and 60s, and maybe even extending into the early 70s, the smartest people in IBM were the mechanical engineers. Yes, I believe that. Early in my time in IBM, I took a visit to Fishkill, which is where the 360 was manufactured at the time, and I was absolutely amazed. And I'll happily tell you about it, but it was all mechanical engineering, and it was quite amazing. And yes. That, there is that, yes. It is a Superfund site, I believe, part of it.